Welcome to our podcast, Accessing Justice, hosted by Communicourt. My name's Miriam John and we're so excited to be launching Series 2. This series will be focusing on hidden disabilities. Joining us for this week's episode is Dr. David Ward. David is an Associate Professor and Director of the Clinical Language Sciences Speech Research Laboratory at the University of Reading. Alongside his work as a professor, he works as a speech and language therapist and is the clinical lead in adult disfluency for Oxford Health. He works with clients who stammer and clutter, and for those who are unsure about what cluttering is, it's a speech and language disorder characterised by fast or jerky speech and often disorganised sounding language. I was very fortunate to have David as a lecturer while studying for my undergraduate degree at the University of Reading. And whilst having trained as a speech and language therapist myself, last summer I found myself in a rather bizarre predicament where I ended up receiving speech and language therapy from David himself. But we'll get into that later. David, welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me today.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So to start us off, could you please tell our listeners what a typical working day in the life of David Ward looks like?
Okay, well, this is kind of a tough one because there wasn't really a typical day, partly because, as you've already said, I kind of have two jobs. So what I do at the University of Reading is rather different to my job as a clinician with Oxford Health. So that split in itself kind of brings quite a difference to your work day. With my job as an associate professor at Reading, it can be a mixture of things. Teaching SLT, speech language therapy students, marking, the inevitable marking, the inevitable admin, applying for grants, meeting with PhD students and postdoctoral students about how various research projects are going. So it really can be very different from day to day at Reading. It's probably a little bit more consistent when I'm in my clinics. So I get to the office on the days that I'm working, because at the moment we're sort of still having this hybrid model where sometimes I'm in my clinic and sometimes I'm working remotely from home. But when I'm in the office or when I'm in clinic, it's a matter of going through the emails, seeing if any new referrals have come through, trying to prioritize those who have who are coming through with late onset stammers. And I think we might get on to talking about what I mean by that a bit later, but prioritizing and then running my clinic list. There are inevitable kind of team meetings and mandatory training.
Yeah.
I think you know all about Miriam, so that's a little bit more kind of formulaic. But having said that, the clients that I see in my clinic, everybody's so different. So even though a day may look very similar, you know, you start off and you have four or five clients that you see, every one of those is going to bring something different to the clinic, and people need to be managed, I think, as individuals. Maybe once again, that's something we'll come on to a bit later.
That's great. So for our listeners who have absolutely no idea what a stammer is, could you please tell us a little bit more about them?
Yes, pretty much everybody in the world is disfluent to some degree. And I'm certainly no exception to that. And anyone who's listening to this will now be listening for every and and restart that I do and every slight hesitation or whatever. So fortunately, we can all do make these kind of minor speech errors without being classed as people who stammer. Stammering is quite specific in that it refers to some sets of behaviors which often aren't the same as the kind of disfluences that we have when we're making regular speech errors. So for example, when I'm going and it's because I'm trying to think about how I can phrase things best, or is the syntax going to work out? Have I forgot to say something? Do I need to go back and say it in a different way? For people who stammer or stutter, they may also say and but often it's uses a postponing device because they fear that an upcoming word is going to be simply impossible to say. So in essence, the difference between stammering and normal non-fluency is that kind of with people who stammer, there is a genuine physiological issue with moving forward with a speech sound, if you like. So you go to say something and it doesn't come out, it simply doesn't come out, or it will come out and it'll be repeated, or it will come out and it'll sound stretched. And that's not something that the person has under their control. Once again, as normally non-fluent people, we by and large, if we get something wrong the first time, we know pretty much we can go back and kind of correct it next time around. People who stammer don't have that luxury. So the core behaviors of stammering tend to be blocks. So that's when you go to say a word and literally nothing comes out. So my name is David.
Yeah.
And it comes out with a bit of effort. Or maybe part word repetition. My name is David. Might be whole repetition. My name is David. And there might be prolongations. My name's David. So those are the core behaviors. But there are loads and loads of other things that people who stammer might also do to try and control those behaviors, which they themselves then become associated with the stammer. So, for example, some people who stammer develop what we call secondary speech characteristics. And these are behaviors which can range from very, very mild things like lip protrusion, slight nod of the head, and sometimes they can be really marked, hand tapping, sort of quite marked head nodding. And these behaviors aren't stammering in themselves, but they're behaviors that occur alongside the stammer, because at some point way back when, the individual has found that using these little kind of accessory movements or whatever they might be actually helps a moment of a speech sound to progress, whereas they otherwise might have got stuck on it. So basically it's do-it-yourself therapy. And they think, okay, wow, that's working, that's great.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can happen. The trouble is, then it's a bit like a drug. You need to kind of make that movement a bit more exaggerated, in the same way that you might need to kind of up the dose of a drug when it starts to wear off. And that's when these sort of quite marked behaviors can kick in. So some people who have stammers may look as if they got some kind of gross motor difficulty as well. So head jerks, and you might think, okay, does this person have maybe some kind of cerebral palsy or something like that? Because there's the strange movements and you're thinking, well, this isn't anything to do with stammering. But quite often this can just be a knock-on effect of the stammer, and someone's trying to kind of manage it in a certain way. Often people will get to the point where they know that they're doing these head movements or whatever it might be, excessive hand gestures. It can be a whole range of movements. Whistling, clicking noises. They know that they're doing it, but it's become so ingrained, it's very difficult for them to move on from that. But it's ironic that sometimes those movements can actually be the more distracting for a listener than the original stammer. So stammering is complex because it can sort of snowball.
So a question that I get often asked by friends and family when they find out that I'm a speech and language therapist, probably because a lot of people associate stammering with speech therapy, is what's the difference between stammering and stuttering? I'm sure you'll be able to answer this a lot more eloquently than I would.
Okay, this is an easy one. They're exactly the same thing. These are really good questions. And it's a very pertinent one, joking apart. I think stammering is used traditionally, it's been used in the UK. But my understanding now is that north of the border in Scotland and in Ireland, they're using the word stuttering. Certainly in other parts of the English-speaking world, in the States, in North America, Canada, Australia, South Africa, the term is stuttering. It means exactly the same thing. Just occasionally, I'll see someone who comes to my clinic and they'll say, I think there's something wrong with my speech fluency. I don't stutter, but I stammer. Okay, what do you mean by that? So some people do have a kind of an internal sense of what they mean by those two words. But for us as professionals, they're just exactly the same thing.
So what some people may not know is that stammers can be either developmental or they can be acquired. So David, would you mind telling us a little bit about the difference between the two and the causes of stammers?
Yes. Okay, so maybe the last question first. What are the causes of stuttering or stammering? See, I'm using the term interchangeably already. The short answer is nobody really knows. There's an awful lot that is known about what's associated with developmental stuttering. So this is the stutter that the majority of people who have stuttering have, the developmental condition, which is the one that you grow up with. It usually starts preschool, can be as late as 9, 10, sometimes even a little bit later than that. But that's the developmental condition. It can run in families. It does run in families. So around 2/3 of all people who have developmental stuttering have some kind of genetic predisposition to it, some kind of familial link. But having said that, there's obviously a third who don't have that link. And I've seen identical twins. One has got Dick twins, one of whom has a really marked stammer, the other one doesn't stammer at all, right? Really? So cannot be the whole answer. Yeah. And I think sometimes we think that the stammering is just one of those things that runs in the family. Well, yes, it can do, but it's not the whole answer. It basically, there's enough evidence now, I think, for us to be pretty conclusive that it's just a neurodevelopmental condition. There's still rather scarce evidence from brain scan studies on younger kids as to exactly how stammering presents neurologically to start off with. But there's plenty of evidence with people who've got developmental stammering but have grown up with the stammer into adulthood to show that the brain functions in a slightly different way, basically. So there are differences in motor speech control areas and also in auditory feedback loops. It's got nothing to do with intelligence. People who stammer have exactly the same spread, IQ sort of mean of around 100, some people above, some people below. So if we start to say that there's a kind of there are neurological differences, well, yes, they are, but they're very specific ones related to motor speech control. So to go back to the genetic thing, people say, well, a genetic predisposition to what? So is it, you know, does this mean that people are naturally predisposed to being anxious? Is that what's behind a stammer? And I think the answer is no. There's more than enough evidence to say that it's just related to problems with the wiring of the brain in motor speech areas, just to put it very, very crudely.
Are there any factors which put people at risk of stammering?
Yes. As I've kind of already mentioned, the genetic factor is a big one. Being male is another one.
Why do you think that is?
Nobody knows. It's interesting. Right across the gambit of developmental speech and language disorders, it seems to be the same ratio of about 4 or 5 to 1, males to females. So this isn't just something that affects stammering. It seems to be the same for a lot of speech and developmental speech and language disorders. Interestingly, a similar number of males and females, young boys and young girls, start to stutter, but females seem to kind of recover better, leaving that 4 or 5 to 1 ratio. So if you look at the figures for, say, 3-year-olds, it's pretty much 1 to 1, the ratio of kind of males to females, and that changes dramatically over the next few years. Those are probably the biggest factors behind the predisposition. Very much occurred to me. I didn't answer the second part of your last question about. I was talking about the behaviour.
No, that's absolutely fine. So we were just talking about the difference between developmental and acquired stammers. And we are going to come on to talk a lot more about acquired stammers later. But could you just quickly tell us the main difference between acquired and developmental stammers?
Sure, absolutely. So just very briefly, I've been talking about developmental stuttering. Stuttering or stammering can start later in life. And there are two main types of late onset stuttering. One is neurogenic stammering, and that's related to some kind of neurological change. And the other is psychogenic stammering, and that's related to some kind of change resulting from a period or periods of psychological stress.
So you will have obviously worked with a range of people who stammer from all sort of walks of life and different ages. What, in your professional opinion, do you think are the main communication barriers for people who stammer?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to answer because, okay, you can conceptualize stuttering as being like an iceberg, right? So what do we know about an iceberg? Well, there's a bit above the waterline, which everybody sees. And then there's the other bit below the waterline. And I think the ratio is kind of like 4/5 of it is below the waterline, which people don't see. And, you know, and if you're the Titanic, you drive straight into it. Stuttering has been kind of likened to that. It's a rather nice analogy, actually. So the bit above the waterline is the things that an observer will see, like the blocks, the repetitions, the sort of things I was just talking about a short while ago. The moments of stuttering, they might also notice those twitches or any other secondary behaviors that I was talking about, which can be associated with stuttering. So that's the stuff that goes above the waterline. And of course, that can be an impediment to communication, because obviously if you're unable to say a word, that's quite a significant issue. Of course, stammering comes in various different degrees. Some people stammer and both you and I would not know they had a stammer. And of course, there are some people who we might see, and these are the people who often appear on the programs that we see on the television, who have really, really marked stammering. So you can see the difficulty in communication that they have from that perspective. But perhaps the bigger issue is the stuff below the waterline, the four-fifths that's below the waterline. And that's really all about how the stammer makes someone feel. And quite often in therapy, what we'll do is we'll address this model with the person we have in front of us. And you'll get loads of responses like, underneath the waterline, what is it that you as a person experience that people who might see you might not know? Things like frustration, anger, isolation, fear, anxiety, all of that stuff. And those can be the biggest impediment to communication. Because while a block might stop you saying a word, the fear of stammering might mean you avoid a whole conversation. You might avoid meeting people, you might avoid meeting groups. There was one person I saw in my clinic recently. She was in her 30s, and I barely noticed any disfluencies, but she had managed to maintain this air of being fluent through extensive use of avoidance techniques. And that's a really big part of what stammering can be for some people, not for everybody, but for some people. So here was a woman who was highly competent, doing well in her job, apparently very successful. And she just broke down and said, I can't keep on doing this. I've built my whole life around my stammer. The subject I chose at school, the people I chose to go out with, the course I took at university, the person I married, all chosen with, can this fit with me not being seen as a person who stammers, right? And she was coming for therapy now because she said, I just feel like I'm living a lie. So in a sense, maybe the stuff that's under the waterline can be the bigger issue. And that's sometimes what we need to address more in therapy rather than what you might think we do as speech language therapists. Yeah.
So we touched a little bit on acquired stammering earlier. And for the listeners who don't know me, as I mentioned before, I did a degree in speech and language therapy at the University of Reading, but I now work for a company called Communicourt. And we work as intermediaries, and what our job is basically to ensure that people with communication difficulties are having access to fair trials within criminal and family proceedings in court. So last summer, I was faced with a very ironic situation. I went to bed kind of speaking how I am now, with kind of no issues at all, and woke up the next morning having developed a stammer. It came completely out of nowhere. I had never stammered before in my life, and yet I woke up hardly being able to get my words out at all. And that is what saw me getting in touch with David for some speech therapy. So David, in your own professional opinion, why is it that you think I developed a stammer completely out of nowhere?
Short answer, I can't be absolutely sure. I think we both agreed that it seemed to be of psychogenic nature, because basically you didn't grow up with a stammer. There's no history of stammering. There's never been any problems with that. There've been no neurological change, not like you had a bang on the head or had a stroke or anything like that. Some, all of these things which can make a difference to speech fluency. So kind of by process of elimination, we kind of came to that conclusion. But your case was a really interesting one, because in the past it's been thought that people who have a psychogenic stammer have some kind of usual background or history of being generally anxious. And often the triggers are fairly obvious. So in the past, people have come to me, and maybe they've been recently bereaved, or they've been in a sort of serious car accident, which has really shaken them up. They've lost their job, serious life events like that. And you can sort of see the link. Increasingly, I'm seeing people rather like yourself, for whom the link is not as obvious. You'll ask the question, have there been any particular stresses in your life? And I think you were saying, no, life can be pretty hectic, but it was perhaps no more hectic than it was usually. So there was nothing particularly obvious that was giving the game away. Why you woke up one morning with that stutter, we don't know. What we do know is that it went reasonably quickly. I think probably, I've got to say, you have a really sort of strong kind of personality, and you seem to kind of handle it with aplomb. I don't know whether you were doing that on the side. But most people, quite understandably, are really, really concerned by this, and not least because they think, why is this happening to me? Surely there must be something wrong with my head, there must be some kind of change. And I think that in itself can create more anxiety. You didn't you didn't come with any of that. You said, look, here it is. You know, I don't know why it's here. And, but, you know, clearly it was distressing you. But the short answer as to kind of why, I'm pretty sure it's stress related. Yes. But I think the stresses and how stress affects us and the way it shows, I think that's kind of changing. And it's something I think we might be coming back to in terms of talking about psychogenic stammering. Why does stress cause these issues? How can we know? We don't know what's... It appears that we sometimes don't know what stress is, you know, or how it's manifesting in ourselves. So in voice disorders, for example, there's been lots of documented cases of psychogenic voice disorders. So people developing problems with hoarse voices or related to resonance, laryngeal function. And that's quite an accepted part of what happened of the voice specialist caseload, as it were. That's quite an unknown thing. Much less so with stuttering. It's an absolute, I don't know how much you Googled it, but there's not a great deal out there. And what there is really, really flaky. You know, there's so much known about the developmental condition, and there's a fair bit known about the neurological correlates of stuttering, you know, in later life. I'm saying that sometimes, you know, neurological change can bring on stutter. But in terms of the psychogenic stuff, or functional fluency disorder, as probably the medics would call it, it's just really an open book. And I think we're terrified of going there as clinicians, because it is in so much in danger of misinterpretation. And I don't think anyone wants to stick their head above the parapet and say, okay, we think it's X, Y, and Z. The data just aren't out there. And in fact, I've just got a PhD student starting with me now at Reading who is looking into this precise thing. So I'm really hoping in 3 years' time we'll have some answers. The answers that we've got at the moment are really unsatisfactory. They relate to older pieces of research, which has shown subsequently, anecdotally, my clinics and clinics across the world, as not really being quite right. You know, there are supposed lists of things which are associated with psychogenic stuttering, you know, in terms of the symptoms and the onsets, and it just doesn't hold water. And you're a really nice case in point. You know, you shouldn't have that psychogenic stuttering, but you did. And I think we must kind of still think that it is some kind of stress-related thing, even though you weren't recognizing the stress. I'm seeing people in my clinic increasingly who have really similar issues to you. They're coming saying, yeah, just woke up with this. I don't feel any more stress than I normally do. On earth's going on? And I don't have a ready answer for them. I think in terms of why stammering, I think stress just affects different people in different ways. When I get really, really stressed, I find it difficult to find words and actually just physically express myself. It's not a stammer, but it's almost just like a kind of under extreme moments of stress, I sort of almost grind to a halt. That's how it gets me. I mean, and that's just a temporary thing. But people respond differently. And medics will tell you about, and you can read about people with functional medical disorders, so people who have hemiparesis, which have absolutely no neurological correlate to them. So people who functionally cannot move one side of their body, and it's purely functional. Same thing with voice disorders. And it seems that the same thing can happen with stammers. So it can bring on disfluencies in the same way that it can bring on problems with vocal cord vibration for people who have psychogenic voice disorders. So if we're doing this again in 3 years, yeah, PhD student, hopefully, I mean, it sounds like I'm joking about it, but I'm not really. There's so little out there that's been really kind of studied in any sort of systematic ways.
No, and absolutely. That was my experience. When my stammer came about, I was furiously Googling and trying to figure out what it was that could have possibly caused my stammer. And I was really, really shocked at how limited the research was, how the research kind of hadn't moved on since the 7 years that had passed since I was at university. And I had a lot of time to sort of reflect on what I was going to do if my stammer didn't go away. So for the listeners who don't kind of know my story, my stammer ended up staying for about a month. At times it got a lot worse to the point where I could get nothing out. At other times it would just sort of affect my fluency. But I did wake up one day and the stammer completely went away. As quickly as it had kind of come on, it was completely gone. But over that month that I was unable to work, I had a realization of what one of my biggest fears was in life, and that was not being able to do my job properly, not feeling like I was able to use my degree, having spent 4 years working really hard at university and having found a career which I loved and felt very passionately about, I was faced with this sudden prospect of maybe not being able to do it. And court environments are incredibly stressful. And it was interesting, we had discussions, you and me, David, about the impact that the stress that I was feeling about not knowing what was happening and sort of the impact that might be having on my stammer. And one of the things that I remember quite clearly that you said at the beginning of our sessions was that I almost needed to make almost peace with the fact that this stammer might not go away. But I also remember you saying that it might just go away at some point. But yeah, I remember feeling incredibly frustrated by that, because I very much felt like I don't want to stammer, so I'd actually quite like it to go away right now. And as much as I sort of came across as being calm and sort of, you know, using this experience to sort of have a better understanding of other people who stammer, I was incredibly frustrated and incredibly disheartened by the sort of lack of understanding and lack of control that I felt kind of what was going to happen. And I particularly didn't like being told that I was stressed, because I didn't always feel stressed. So in my head, I was like, well, I'm not stressed, so why am I stammering? And sort of being told that maybe stress was the cause of my stammer felt like it was, in a way, maybe undermining what was happening to me. So I thought it might be a bit helpful for you to maybe touch a little bit more on what you meant when you said that I should try and make peace with the stammer.
Yeah, it's a kind of ironic situation. But the issue with psychogenic stammering, somewhere on the line, and as I said, it's not clear where along what line it was with you that kind of kicked this off. But the problem when you have that sudden onset stammer, you wake up, bam, all of a sudden, you're almost incapable of any fluent speech whatsoever. I mean, that's a pretty scary thing, even if you have that kind of air of calm, which you did so well with. And yes, and the most understandable thing in the world is, I just want this to go, right? But ironically, that's kind of what's perpetuating it.
Yeah.
If you weren't as anxious about getting back to work, which of course you would be, it's the most natural thing in the world. But it's, I call it the art of fighting without fighting. Yeah. The more you want it to go, the more you kind of feed it, the more you feed that anxiety and the tension of what if it is there forever? And absolutely, I mean, you know, when it's there for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, you think, well, maybe this is me for the rest of my life, you know. And the more that those kind of, it's all that underwater stuff, it's that kind of the mind kind of playing mind games with you, albeit with this very, very real issue. The stammer isn't made up. It's not pretend stammer. It's absolutely real. But the way you get rid of it is by trying to, yes, as I said, sometimes you use mindfulness concepts, you know, so just very, very basic ones like, okay, yes, you acknowledge it's there. You don't want it. It's neither a good thing nor a bad thing. Just think of it as being a thing. Don't worry about when it's going to go. It's, of course, very easy for me to sit there as a clinician and say that. But when you're kind of sitting on the other side of the table thinking, well, yeah, that's okay for you. You try going through what I'm going through. But you can, the more you can make your peace with it, the less it's going to happen. And the more you try not to kind of try to put a timeline on it, once again, that's dangerous. And of course, it's an obvious question. People say, well, when is it going to go?
And I remember that was a question that I asked you on our first session. When was it going to go away?
I'd be asking it too. But in a way, if you can avoid that, just saying, I don't know, it might go tomorrow. It might be around for an extended period of time, but don't ask yourself that question. Just think of it as just being something that, okay, for sure you don't want it, but just try and, as much as you possibly can, carry on with your life in a stress. And here's the thing, you need to try and take away the stress, which for you was difficult because you didn't know where it was coming from, because you didn't really identify with any particular stress. But the more people can get back into their usual routines, often that's really helpful, but it's got to be done in really, really carefully. I'm seeing someone at the moment who has a psychedelic stammer, and she's responding really well. It's taking more time, but she's going back to work on a part-time basis. But it would be a very, very bad idea, because her job gets loads of work dumped on her, and for her to go back into that environment could really set things back. So it's a matter of trying to find that balance between keeping regular routines and just not being controlled by the stammer in as much as you possibly can. And it's finding that balance for each individual person. And it is different from one person to another.
And I definitely relate to sort of the more I thought about my stammer, the worse it seemed to get. And I remember very distinctly getting very frustrated with my friends, because at times I would want them to just finish my sentence and put me out of my misery. But at other times I'd be really frustrated that they were finishing my sentence, because sometimes they would miss what I was trying to say. And I really learned sort of how much fluency has a role in sort of things like humour. And if I was wanting to make a joke about something, I'd get so frustrated because it would take me so long to get to the actual punchline. But yeah, definitely reflecting, I'm able to see that the times that where my stammer was the most severe was the times when I was worrying most about it. And it was just like a vicious cycle. It was incredibly frustrating. And I realised how much time I was spending sort of perceiving how other people might be perceiving me and what I was doing and how I was sounding. And I was sort of able to see the impact that was having on my fluency, this sort of obsession I had with what other people were thinking about me. And I would be sat in sort of social groups being so worried about people thinking I was stammering and thinking, oh my goodness, why is she sounding like that, that my stammer would just get increasingly worse.
There are some sort of basic tools which can help. Relaxation can be great. Some people just respond with that. One thing that we did was try to use that prolonged speech. And that's a really kind of abnormal way of speaking, where you drag words out like that. It's not something I normally do, but that can sometimes be really helpful for people who have got sudden onset stammers. Because for some people, at least, it seems to be able to knock that repetitive type of stammer, which is quite often what people with psychogenic stammers have. So it will almost be like this. So to get through those repetitions, you stretch things out. It's almost like breaking that pattern, even though the pattern you're breaking with is itself abnormal. The fact that you can change it sometimes can just click the brain to think, oh, okay, this doesn't need to be here anymore, because it does seem that in some way, shape, or form, the stammer is sort of, it's acting as some kind of protective mechanism. It's not working, but it's alerting us to the fact that we're stressed. You can break that pattern. You can break that kind of pattern of thinking, okay, well, no, I don't have to speak like this. I can sort of change it. So that's something that can work for some people. But like, just to reiterate, it's really different things for different people.
And one thing that I found really funny was that my ability to sing was completely intact. I remember on the day, it must have been the first day that I started having this stammer, my brain sort of went straight back to a moment in my first year lecture where I remember learning that people who stammer often kind of retain the ability to sing fluently, and that sort of... that sort of area isn't affected at all. So I remember trying it out in the car. So I'd been stammering all day and it had been kind of, you know, scary and shocking that first day. And I was with some friends and I thought, you know what, I'm going to try this out. And I started singing. And I remember my friend was very freaked out because he was like, wait, what? One second he was sort of, you know, really struggling to get anything out. And now you're singing and it seems to be absolutely fine. So what is it about singing that seems to be unaffected by something like stammers? Is it that it uses a different part of the brain, or what is it?
It's loads of things. It's that's unusual, by the way, for people who have psychogenic stammers. That's quite unusual. Mostly people who have psychogenic stammers can't sing, and they're pretty much the only group. Anyone with a developmental stammer, yeah. I don't think I've known anyone in quite a few decades of seeing people with stammers. I don't know anyone who couldn't sing fluently. So why? Loads of potential reasons. Yes, you're right, uses a slightly different part of the brain. Music has rhythm, which helps. And way back when, therapy was associated with metronome speech. So if you talk in time with that metronome, so rhythm is definitely fluency enhancing. You can also the way that we breathe when we're singing is different. So we're using diaphragmatic breathing, which in itself has been shown to be helpful for people who have stammering. So breathing from lower down, stomach breathing is sometimes called. That's helpful. But also the amount of time that we're breathing out to the amount of time we're breathing in, that ratio changes. So the amount of air we're moving and the ratio in which we're moving it, breathing in to breathing out, that's all very different when we sing. And also, and this is why I thought that the prolonged speech might work for you, Miriam, is because if you can sing fluently, basically that's what prolonged speech is. It's kind of almost like a halfway house between speaking and singing. So vowel elongation, you're stretching the words right out in front of you. So the vocal cords are vibrating much more of the time when we're singing compared to the times when they're not vibrating. So people always think, oh, gosh, isn't it wonderful? So-and-so can, you know, sing and what a fantastic ability it is. But actually, technically, speaking is harder because the voice switching between some sounds which are voiceless, like S's and F's and SH sounds, H's. So we're swapping between those sounds much more when we speak than when we're singing. And on top of all of the other stuff. So the voice switching, which is more complex motorically, right? So if you've got a system which is compromised motorically for speech, then anything that makes it easier is going to help. And singing is technically easier. The other thing is that often when we sing, we go into, we take on like a different persona, right? So in the same way that some people I know can be highly fluent, they put on a different accent. Putting on a, you know, Geordie accent, or if you're American, you put on a Southern accent or a Southern Texan accent or something like that. So it's almost like it's not really you being you. So there are psychological elements perhaps to singing as well. So basically loads and loads of fluency enhancing things going on when we sing compared to when we're speaking.
So my next question is kind of around coronavirus and how that's impacted people who stammer. So the Michael Palin Centre is an organisation that helps people from all around the world who stammer. I read a recent report from them which said that they've seen a significant increase in referrals to them over the past 2 years. So how is it that you think that the pandemic might have had an effect on people who stammer?
This is complex. Because I agree, I'm seeing this in my clinic, and my colleagues are reporting exactly the same thing, massive increase in numbers coming through the system. And interestingly, continuing, even though, well, COVID is, well, it seems like it's going to be with us, you know, for the foreseeable future in some way, shape or form, but I guess we are at least out of lockdown now, but and yet the numbers still continue to increase. It might make sense, yes. COVID, hugely, a period of huge anxiety for most people, perhaps, in various different ways. So, yes, it makes sense that, A, that could trigger some kind of psychogenic stammering. And it's also the case that it could also exacerbate stammering for people who've got the developmental condition. Because what I haven't really kind of made clear is that people who grew up with a stammer are also affected by changes in, you know, stress. So there are kind of all those correlates. And, yeah, for sure, I think it's more stress, more impact, more referrals. It may also be the case that maybe some people, if they're being furloughed, just have more time and think, okay, yeah, maybe I can book in for some speech sessions now. So I don't know, but I think it's a really interesting point. And certainly it is a thing, you know, everybody, and I suspect this isn't limited just to the fluency, voice, other areas of speech language therapy, which kind of have psychological correlates to them, I think are seeing similar increases as well.
So as I mentioned before, I work as an intermediary, and part of my job role is to help ensure that people with communication difficulties are getting access to fair trials and hearings, and that they are able to effectively participate during proceedings. So David, while you don't work kind of in court with people with communication difficulties, I thought it'd be interesting to still ask you the question. What do you think the main difficulties would be for somebody who stammers within the criminal justice system?
Right. Well, actually, I don't do it so much now, but I used to. I've done a fair bit of forensic work in courts as an expert witness. So I know how intimidating court can be. I don't know, maybe you're used to them, you probably are, but I felt very much under pressure, which is, you know, you're there to have your evidence examined, and you know, see, that's a kind of pressure environment. So stress is a factor, no matter whether you have, well, no matter whether you have a stammer or not, for a start. If we don't have any disorder of fluency or concerns about our fluency, chances are we're going to stumble more when we're put under pressure. And that tends to happen exponentially for people who have a stammer. So quite often, if you ask the question, what sort of situations are difficult for you to speak in, does it make any difference, you know, who you're talking to? Mostly, and there's definitely variation, but by and large, people will say, yeah, I'm better in one-to-one situations with people I know. I'm worse with strangers and in large groups and in formal situations. And often it's with people who have power. It may not just be, you know, it may be the police, but it may be their GP, just that kind of authority figure. Not so much power, but an authority figure, perhaps, is a better way of expressing it. So in court, you've got that in spades. You've got, you know, everybody dressed up. Yeah, absolutely. So it's already putting someone who has a stammer at a disadvantage. There's the obvious knock-on effect that there's every likelihood that someone is going to be more disfluent. So they might have a certain level of stammering. And in court, that level might go up. And I think there could be a danger that that might be misperceived. People say, oh, he's stammering more. You know, maybe he or she, or maybe the evidence, you know, maybe they're making this evidence up as they go along. They seem indecisive. They might seem to be changing their words around. And that might well be because words they might normally be able to say under this increased pressure, they can't. They're looking for a different word to say to substitute for the word that they feel they can't get out. I'm all the time noticing that everybody is noticing them, and they, you know, depending on the court, you know, if there's a jury there, if it's Crown Court or whatever, all the eyes are on them. It's just a petrifying experience, and one that can make a difficult situation worse. And I think it's very easy for someone who has a stammer to potentially be misinterpreted, you know, misunderstood as being evasive, not good at expressing themselves, simply because they're so anxious. They might present as being unreliable witnesses or uncertain in what they're saying. If there's blocks and hesitations, there may be unfinished sentences or excursions, which might not make sense to the court. But these might be happening purely because what they want to say, they cannot say it. I'm generalizing here because some people, you know, stammering has this kind of whole range right across the board, from the person, the 35-year-old lady who I mentioned. If she was in court, I don't think anybody would notice that she even had a stammer.
Okay.
But probably would be furiously kind of figuring out how she could say things in a way that maintained that level of fluency. And then there are some people who might stammer overtly, but are really confident with themselves. And so you might see loads of stammering, but they might be incredibly direct.
So we are slightly running out of time, and we could definitely do an entirely new and whole podcast on this area that we're about to touch on briefly now. But as I mentioned in the intro, one of the other areas of expertise that you have is cluttering. And cluttering, I think, is something that people are even less familiar with than stammering. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have never even heard of it. So could you tell us a little bit more about what cluttering is?
Yeah. It's quite an important thing, actually, not least because it's a fluency disorder that tends to often go hand in hand with stammering, stuttering. So as you kind of rightly kind of said right back at the beginning of this, you got to the nub of it, but just to try and expand on that. Basically, cluttering is a disorder of fluency which seems to be related to stuttering, in that it seems to be a genetic component and a crossover between a lot of people who clutter also stutter. Cluttering, it's been poorly diagnosed and understood in the past. So once again, be careful how you Google this, anyone who's listening. We're actually currently writing a piece for the British Stammering Association, which is also known as Stammer. So hopefully within the next month, we'll have a big piece on their website with links, so people who are interested can find out more about it. But basically, cluttering is a disorder of speech fluency characterized by overly rapid speech or jerky speech. That's the essence of it. But in addition, that in itself isn't cluttering. That's kind of like the foundations of cluttering. Someone who seems to speak too quickly to be articulate. So in that sense, it's really often quite different from stammering. Most people who stammer tend to speak more slowly, but people who clutter tend to speak more quickly, or have little bursts of fast speech, which are kind of unintelligible. Accompanied by that, sometimes there are problems with speech rhythm, pauses where you wouldn't expect them to be pauses, and overly running together of words. So television might be something like television. And well, you could hear what I was saying then, but in fact, there were only television. There was just three syllables there as opposed to four. So if I can give you my classic example of someone who clutters, and as someone who is actually on the cluttering spectrum myself, I'm entitled to do this. So I might be talking like this. I might have something like that, and then I'll be talking like this again. And you're probably thinking, hang on, what was that bit in the middle? I got the other bits, but what was that bit in the middle? That's typical of cluttering. So cluttering is speech which is basically rushed. It sounds disorganized, rushed, hard to understand. What's confusing about it is that it may not be there all the time. So you may actually understand, and your mind will fill in the blanks, and you'll guess the bits which you didn't quite hear. So quite often, as listeners, we compensate for the fact that we don't understand, and we sort of gloss over it. But people who have more severe cluttering, you can't do that. And you're just thinking, I just can't understand this person. So this is a separate speech disorder to stuttering. But as I said, they often co-occur. So some people have this combination of speaking very quickly, but then going into kind of stammering blocks. And then that can sound really, really confused. I think cluttering is worth flagging up. And I thank you for kind of asking me to talk about this, Miriam, because once again, it can really be misdiagnosed, and people who clutter often come across as being really disorganized, not really knowing what they're talking about, because it's often sort of really just kind of higgledy-piggledy speech. And you think, is this person actually kind of, in terms of IQ, is there maybe possibly a learning disorder there? Often just come across as being really disorganized. You also mentioned at the beginning, quite rightly, it's strongly linked to problems with language, high-level language processing. So sometimes the narrative that they have, people who plot it, it might just come across as being confused. So bits of a story might appear in slightly the wrong sequence. So if you've got someone who's speaking really quickly and probably the court's struggling to hear them, that in itself might be thinking, well, they're just trying to sort of say stuff so quickly that they're getting over and done with, and is there some kind of ulterior motive here? And also in terms of the sequencing of events, that could be impacted. So poor auditory memory as well can be something that's associated with cluttering. So just basically, to put it in a nutshell, often people who clutter come across as being kind of scatty and disorganized. And once again, there may be questions as to their reliability and their kind of trustworthiness as witnesses. And yet, as you rightly say, Marine, a lot of people don't know about it. Some speech therapists don't know about it, which is not good, but it is very much a real thing. And I think it's worth flagging up here because I think most people will accept and understand the pressures that people who stutter have. And they can accept the fact that, yes, I can see the struggle there. Someone's trying to kind of force a word out. I can see that's difficult. Almost, I feel their pain type thing. But with cluttering, it's very much the opposite. It's almost like a kind of comedic thing. It can come across as just being, whoa, just slow down, stop all that. And it comes across as being a trivial thing. It's not. A lot of people who clutter don't know that it's a genuine disorder, and they get quite frustrated when people say, I can't hear what you're saying, slow down. So there's often this kind of loop of frustration on behalf of the person who clutters, and also frustration on behalf of those who are trying to listen. So I think it's worth noting that that can be a serious impediment, I would say, to giving clear evidence.
Thank you so much, David, for giving your time today. And thank you again for the help that you gave me in the summer. It's been a really fascinating discussion, and I'm sure our listeners will have really enjoyed it. So thank you again.
It's been an absolute pleasure. If anyone wants to get in contact or has any queries or questions, my email, contact me at Reading. It's d.ward@reading.ac.uk. If anyone's got any queries or questions, I'd be happy to be in touch.
Thank you so much to David for his time, and Miriam for speaking so honestly about her experiences. If you've enjoyed this podcast, let us know on Twitter or LinkedIn. You can find more episodes of our Accessing Justice podcast on Spotify or Podbean, or visit www.communicourt.co.uk.